another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I'm bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved with punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, huge one, ginormous one, Daryl Jennifer from the Bad Brains, from Stealth, from White Man Dingoes, from the Bad Brains. One of the most important bands of all time. And we talk about a lot of stuff. This is a good one. I'm excited for you to hear this. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to the email address, turnedoutapunkpodcast@gmail.com. That is run by my brother and show producer and guest booker extraordinaire. Thank you, Tristan, for all the hard work you do. And thank you very much to my manager, Brian Schwartz, for the assist on this one, too. They made this happen. So thank you to them for this. Tristan can get the message to me that way. You can also find me on Twitter and Instagram at Left4Damien. The podcast also has an Instagram at TurnedOutAPunk, and that is also run by Tristan. So you can find me through those places. If you want to support the show, the best way to support the show is by telling your friends about it. You can also subscribe to it and rate it if you're listening to it on iTunes. Thank you to everyone that does do that. You can also support the show by heading over to patreon.com/turnedoutapunk. And really huge thank you to the people that do that. And, really thank you for supporting the show. And speaking of support, this show would not be possible without the kind, loving support the fine folks at Vans, who came aboard a few years ago and said, Damien, let us help cover the cost of this thing. And they do. They helped me cover the cost, which has been phenomenal. Allow me to keep doing this thing. And so, and I can't wait till we can all go back to doing live things again. And then, you know, go to the House of Vans and hopefully be able to do some live podcasts and stuff. Because, looking forward to that. Getting out of the house. Hoo-hoo-hoo. But in the meantime, you know, I'm having a lot of fun. Doing the podcast. And thank you for each and every one of you that tune in to all these episodes that are going up there. And hopefully we're keeping it interesting because, man, it's definitely really interesting for me recording them. Holy. All right. Speaking of interesting, today on the show, Daryl Jennifer. Daryl Jennifer is someone who I've always wanted to talk to like this. I met him briefly when I was a kid at a Stealth show when Stealth played as part of Snow Jam. And very nice, but it was a very brief conversation. So to be able to sit down with him like this, oh, that's why I do this thing. And we go deep on all sorts of stuff. This is a really fun conversation. I don't know, like, check out the Bad Brains. It just seems like ridiculous to have to say that, because if you have not checked out the Bad Brains, you're really missing out on something. The only note I have to get to before the episode starts is actually the Infest festival that Daryl brings up that, you know, I've said I've never heard of. I have subsequently researched, and yes, indeed, it did take place in Canada. And my gosh, I cannot believe I did not know about this festival. This is one of the most ridiculous lineups ever for a concert. I can't believe this thing. Anyway, I will be talking about this on Turned Out of Punk Footnotes, I'm sure, at some point with Chris O'Toole. So if you're on Patreon, I'm sure you will hear this discussed. But what a show. Holy, what a show. Anyway, what a show also with this podcast. Sit back, relax, and enjoy Daryl Jennifer on Turned Out of Punk. All right, Daryl, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Yeah, man, thanks for recognizing Bad Brains. You know what I mean? It's been a lifetime for us.
Well, I was just about to tell you this off air, and I spared you from it so I wouldn't have to repeat it, but I think without the Bad Brains, none of this would be happening. You know, like I've been lucky enough to be playing music as my job professionally for like 20 years now, and I wouldn't be doing it without you guys. And I'm not just speaking for myself. Like it's hard to imagine a world without your band. And I mean that in the most positive way possible.
Thanks, man. But that's funny you say that, because just this morning when I was waiting to do this interview with you, I was listening to Chicoria, mm-hmm. who recently passed away. And, I had been doing some work with Lenny White, the drummer from Return to Forever. And I was sitting in my studio and I was like, man, I want to be able to tell Chick, without Chick, then there was no me. And my whole life, has been Bad Brains or music, but Return to Forever and The Magic of Chicoria was my, and Lenny White and Stanley Clarke and those guys, that's what they mean to me, you know? So I guess this is a big tapestry of musical love that we have going on here.
Absolutely. Well, and I think that's the reason I started this podcast is because it gives me an opportunity to tell people how much their music meant to me, but then to also ask them all the nerdy questions that I wouldn't have an opportunity to ask them otherwise.
Yeah, man. Go ahead. Shoot them.
Okay. Well, I got to start this off the way they all start off, which is, Daryl, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Well, I think I got into punk naturally from like being a kid back in the 70s. That's about music. Like, there was no DJs or rappers back then. So in my hood, it was like sports or you played guitar, drums, you know, that was the thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I wanted to play guitar from an early age, and in wanting to play guitar, I guess I just didn't really want to stick with what I was supposed to be playing. You know what I mean? I had sort of an adventurous musical, you know, I had adventure with music. So like, you know, where I'm from, it's like go-go, it's like R&B, it's Motown, it's soul music, you know. But for me, for some reason, I was like, man, you know, they used to say, Daryl, you listen to a white boy radio station and stuff, you know what I mean? But it wasn't nothing racial, it was just that I feel like now that I look back that I was kind of blessed with like a versatile taste at a very young age. So when I discovered punk, right, I thought, wow, you know, it was real exciting. Some of the first records I heard, like The Damned and The Ramones. But I remember feeling, because I was kind of shy, you know what I mean, as a player. And then I thought, wow, like punk rock was kind of showing me I didn't have to be all, you know, virtuosic and all that. It was mainly about like having something to say with my musical expression. Mm-hmm. Within my capabilities. That's what attracted me to punk. You see what I'm saying? So I went on to invent my own punk. But yeah, the thing about it was, because I liked Return to Forever and all the, you know, the musical chops and stuff that those guys were bringing back in that day, I felt like I had an advantage musically to be able to create my style of punk with maybe a little bit more technical but it was all natural. That's the next thing when I look back at. No one in Bad Brains, we never sat down and said we're going to do this or be that. We were just a teenage band like everyone else. But we had this, it was a perfect timing for us, you know, because being some 70s brothers and then discovering the freedom of punk rock and then being adventurous with creating our own style of punk rock. Like, you can even notice in a song like Sailing On how it like, it's like speeding along with these little breaks and stuff. Then at the end, it kind of plays like a lovely major seventh chord. Mm-hmm. To be like, I just give thanks. It's not nothing contrived or nothing we sat down and thought. But as I look back, I think, man, that's cool that, you know, being a spiritual cat, that the great spirit gave us the courage to say, yo, we're going to play fancy shit. And then if we want, we can just start playing reggae. You know what I mean? So that's the blessing to me.
Well, yeah, no, in reading interviews with you over the years, I've always been blown away by how just musically versed you were at such a young age. You know, like you're talking about, you know, even pre-punk stuff, like the stuff that you're into, in addition to being into, you know, all sorts of stuff, you're also into the stuff that you kind of called doomsday music, what I read, with like, you know, Black Sabbath.
Oh, yeah. Well, you see what it was with that, right? Which probably has a lot to do with how I view, because I'm not a musician, you know. I'm a guy with a knack to play a bunch of instruments, and you know, I want to do it. It's not like a musical thing to me. So like there's Led Zeppelin, and then there's Black Sabbath, mm-hmm. right? So now, like Black Sabbath, like Sweet Leaf and Iron Man, you know, that I was like as a young dude down in D.C., black dude in the hood. That to me seemed like a darker, harder, that's why I said doomsday sort of riffs. Whereas Zeppelin felt more technical, happy sometimes, you know, blue, you know mm-hmm. Zeppelin. Everybody.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So, you know, being in the 70s and you wanting to play guitar or bass and you wanting to play various styles, which that's to me now as I look back is the key, wanting to play various styles. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of cats that I grew up with and musicians in all walks that kind of stick to what they're, you know, like what they're supposed to in their hood play or their culture or their race. Whereas I never really thought about any of that. I was just mainly peeping riffs and, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So the rock riffs of Black Sabbath, that's that, a lot of that, like the Bad Brains to me being, I composed, you know, the riffs and shit, me and Dr. No, but the Bad Brains riffs in punk, it's like the Ramones and the Damned, and then like Black Sabbath being the godfather of that whole approach to us. You see what I'm saying? So when I go to formulate or figure my own style riff, it's basically coming off a Sweet Leaf. Not so much even Hendrix. You see what I'm saying? And like, we don't do, you know, the blues thing, is, which I always found odd as years went on and I look back. It's like Bad Brains never really did the blues-based like riffage. Although I did kind of slip some in a little bit on the Eye Against Eye album. But yeah, man, it's, to me now that I look back, it's just all about being blessed with a sense of versatility, like, you know, yeah.
No, and I think that's the thing is, you know, like yourselves, there's like certain groups throughout music history that there's no precursor to. Like, you can't hear where the influences clearly come from, but I guess that's where that alchemy is, where you're pulling in all these different disparate things and creating, you know, your own type of punk, as you said.
Yeah, it's about playing what you like. You see, that's a good cool thing about punk, because it showed, like, you know, imagine you're a kid in the 70s and you play guitar, you want to play like Guitar Heroes. Mm-hmm. Then all of a sudden you hear like there's a music with a real positive or a negative energy. It's energy back then, but it's like not necessarily attached to like virtuistic, you know.
Yeah.
It's attached to having something to say and saying it and being creative. And that's what I believe punk rock did to us in DC, was showed us that, yo, you can make your own thing. I love it. You know, I'm just talking about it. It makes me feel like smile, you know. It's like make whatever, like whenever I sit down and write some music or make a track or a riff, I always think that, I think first, what do you want to do? Like sometimes I say, I want this shit to start like a brick wall, or I want this to feel like confused, or I want this to feel, you know what I mean? It's a way of feeling I want it to feel. Then I interpret it, you know, on the fretboard, which I know shit about music, A minor, B and all that stuff. I really don't know a lot of that, but I do know the spacings and the you know, how they feel. I'm just now starting to learn like what, like major and minor, you know what I mean? The difference of how they feel and what they mean. And I never really dawned, you know, none of this stuff never really, it wasn't any fun, I guess, for me as a young, you know what I mean? Fuck, I want to be thinking about all this shit for when I can just like do my thing on this fretboard with these frets and these spaces and these dots.
Well, I think that's the thing, you know, you guys really bring to punk rock is this virtuosity, you know, and it's not like, you know, like you're saying, you're not into virtuosity. And so it's not virtuosity in like knowing the notes, but it's like a virtuosity in you still take this super seriously and you do it to the best of your ability. And that's why to me, you're an uncoverable band, because no one can kind of match your approach to these songs, just because it's just so virtuosic in its own kind of way.
Yeah, being in Bad Brains taught me about chemistry. You know what I mean? Because, you know, we all have different chemistries, but for a long time, you know, like myself, Dr. No, and HR, and we all, what I'm trying to say is it was a struggle for us, but a struggle for us being Bad Brains and being and doing it as intense and doing it as serious as all what you just described. You know, it was a struggle. A lot of times, I don't mean to like compare shit, but sometimes I say that like being in Bad Brains was like my like going to war or something, you know, like being in like Vietnam or something. How, you know what I mean? It's not what all people think when they see it as a band and touring and people loving you and all that stuff. But really, it was a struggle about unity, and it was a mission, like being put on a mission. Like sometimes I would leak. Like feel like, why do I have to be this every night? You know, it's a lot, you know what I mean? But plus I care, you know what I mean? It's when you care about something and you're also wondering why. You're like, I used to go in the dressing room and say like, why couldn't we be like Dave Matthews or something? You know what I mean? Yeah. Why the hell? But I would love it. It was just like, wow, wow. You know what I mean? After it even happened for us, like we would go do a show, go in the dressing room and look at each other like, wow. And sometimes why? And sometimes, you know, so it's a mission for us, you know?
Yeah. Well, and especially because you're carving a lot of the paths that bands travel on now at that point, like, you know, pre Nirvana, pre everything touring, like, you know, you are that first wave of that.
Yeah, man. And we didn't know, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. To us, we had blinders on to PMA, to Rastafari, to being who we are, knowing who we are as men and artists and, you know, like dudes with the knack to play music. You see what I'm saying? So we knew that and we rode on that, but mainly riding on Unity, PMA, and feeling the energy from the kids and the fans. And you know what I mean? That's what we rode on blindly. Like we did. If we, I guarantee you, if you took all the bad rates back, they would be like, no way. Because it was not easy. You know what I mean? But through the teachings of PMA and we, you know, I guess, and we stuck with what we, our mission was. And we were blessed to recognize our brotherhood more than being in a band or some shit. Like I always used to say, like, we didn't come together like bass player wanted on the flyer in the college dorm or something. We didn't, you know, we were brothers before Bad Brains. There's people that know us and know of us as musicians in our hoods before all that saw us becoming that, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm.
Where were you kind of hearing about bands like Budgie and stuff like that? Because like obviously Black Sabbath is popular and Led Zeppelin are popular, but there's, you know, this stuff's not necessarily being played on the radio. Like where are you kind of discovering all this kind of stuff?
That's a good question because we are my partner and homeboy in tech and Sid McCray, right?
Rest in peace.
Yes. Yeah, he was the one, like me and him would share, like I would be playing, like he would tell me, man, I appreciate the way you know, show me that George Duke or that Return to Forever or Mahavishnu. And then I'd be like, you put me onto Budgie or like Celtic Frost or something like that. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, or like Electric Light Orchestra or something, you know, like that's Sid, but those bands, like the Damned, Electric Light Orchestra, Manfred Mann or something. Then you got like, you know, shit that I would never, weird shit that I would never consider. And that's where Budgie came in. And Budgie too was a big influence on, just brain salad surgery. Sometimes a song of a band can like have a great influence on people, you know, not necessarily the band or their catalog or nothing about them. Mm-hmm. Maybe even the album cover in one song. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's what Budgie had on me. and I loved him and the voices.
What about like the Stooges and Roxy Music and any sort of that sort of precursor to punk? Like, were you aware of that stuff or was that kind of too obscure at that point even?
Nah, I never really got into those groups. Mm-hmm. It's like when I started getting into it, the wildest shit I was into was the shit that was on No New York album.
Yes.
Like, I was into that, right? You know, I liked it for some reason. And in the staples of like the Damned, the Ramones, Dead Boys.
Yeah.
Like I'm from that. Like that's why sometimes I feel I don't want to offend, you know, bands from the 90s. I don't really know a lot of that mm-hmm. stuff.
Mm-hmm. No, I totally get that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess like, you know, you brought up the No New York comp and I remember reading that you bought, that was one of the first punk records you bought, right?
Sid came over to my house with that record.
Oh, he brought it over to your house. Okay. I'm just, yeah. I'm fascinated by that. Did you have any interactions with those people when you guys moved to New York a little bit later?
No, I used to see them a lot. Like, what's my man, Elliot Sharp. And I used to see them, you know, yeah. Like we were in the Lower East Side. Like I used to see Basquiat walking down the street or something. You know what I mean? It's like we were in New York. It was timing. So, and where we were, almost everyone that was on those albums probably was like sitting in front of, you know, I mean, it was like a community. It's like nobody really like, oh shit, there's Lydia Lunch or something like that, you know?
Did you go to see any of that stuff or was it were the Bad Brains in a completely different scene by that point?
Yeah. By the time we started kicking in that, it's like, I would see like Von Elmo, mm-hmm. you know, or I'd see like, or talk about the Plasmatics or something, you know, I'd see like I mentioned Elliot Sharp during this, but during that time, that stuff was starting to, it was like we were 1980, You see what I'm saying? When you start seeing Bad Brains, you're talking 1979 turning to 1980 is when they started to like say like hardcore and stuff like that. I didn't really know. You know what I mean? To me, it was just like punk rock.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's amazing how much everything changes in that sort of like 4 year span, 5 year span. It's like it's just so much evolution happens in this little scene that, you know, like you're saying, by the time that hardcore rolls around, there's all these different mutations of this thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Did Mind Power record ever?
Nah. You know, Mind Power, it was like, if you go way back before, like being dudes in the hood that play instruments, mm-hmm. we formed a band, or HR, Doc and Earl were a couple years older than me. They already had a band that they were working on. And then I sort of appeared as the youngest one, and then HR was playing the bass, and then he switched to vocals, and then I filled in on bass, and then we had one song that we wrote that I still remember to this day. It's really, I should probably try to, it was like riffs, it wasn't all lyrics really. But anyway, we had one song, and just like what you just said about how things are changing, it's like summertime, and then it's this, and then it's wintertime, and it's that. So we were like Mind Power on this like DC fusion type of dreams with one song and a couple cats, and then next thing you know, we're Bad Brains. We never had like a show or nothing for Mind Power. All we had was a names for ourselves, and one song.
So how long after Sid joining and taking over vocals did you switch the name to Bad Brains? Like very shortly kind of thing?
Yeah, well, when Sid was... See, what happened, that's another one-song situation too. Like what happened was, when we first came out to want to... You know, when we first wanted to play out, we played in a basement in Maryland, mm-hmm. right? And we formulated this show where Sid would come out and we'd play Regulator. And then at the end of Regulator... he would start to like break shit up, like sort of like James Chance.
Okay, yeah.
Remember how James Chance would like go nuts and get beat up or something?
Yeah.
So we like, you know, we was on that shit too. So at our first show or first couple shows we did, some people in the game were there. So we play Regulator, and then like, you know how every band has the girl that's with them. We had one girl was with us. Her name was Tally, which was Sid's girlfriend. You know, we're just starting, teenagers. So we had it. So like at the end of Regulator, Tally would run out and tackle Sid off stage, right? And Sid, once he did that, Sid would like tear up everything and smash shit up and, you know, break chairs or whatever and leave. And it was basically like a little black James Chance, like out in D.C.,
so. That's awesome. That's
That's where that came from. And then that was on the Sid's only song.
Yeah.
But the thing about Sid was that Sid was a real like a bondage type punk. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So he had a real sinister ideas about what it meant to be punk. And he didn't really like being us being popular. You know what I mean? It's like five people clap for you and now you're sold out.
Yeah. So he only had the one song written with you guys. So when HR comes in to start singing, it's really shortly after that you're doing Black Dot. So you must have written all those songs in really short order.
Yeah, some of those songs and I was just telling that to my wife. A lot of those riffs, like almost all the first riffs are kind of written at once, you know, on a reel to reel.
Holy.
You know, just like a jam.
Yeah, but it's like just what a collection of riffs that you come up with.
Yeah, yeah. It's funny, like it's Don't Need It, right? And then it goes into Super Touch.
Mm-hmm.
And you can tell if you put those songs together, you can imagine that, you know, I myself. And then Doc, we come in and, you know, tweak them out a little bit. And, you know, and HR would be there and listening and getting his vibes on what he feels like he wants to say. And that's how you really do it. You know what I mean? Your singer or whatever is listening to you formulate the music. And while you're doing that, he's formulating what, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's a building process.
Wow, that's amazing. So you only played the one show with Sid on vocals?
I think we played a basement show, maybe another basement show. And then we played one really pivotal show we played on the mall or something like with like hippies or yippies or something. But it was up on like a flatbed stage and stuff like that. It was down on the mall in DC. But the
Okay.
thing about it was it had like a ramp that you go up to go on stage. You know, so
Yeah, yeah.
we thought we were like, you know, in concert or Heart with some fucking somebody. We thought we were Heart when we went up on that ramp to go on that stage. And Sid played there. He sang his song and did his thing on that show. So as we went on in life and we would laugh and talk about it, he would say, "I played that show down the mall." Like, yeah.
Oh, that's so awesome. What was the first concert that you went to? Like, it doesn't have to be punk.
Music concert?
Yeah, any music concert. Yeah.
Oh, I was at James Brown at the Howard Theater in 1964.
Oh my
And I,
God, what a
yeah.
show.
Yeah, and I was like holding my mother's hand, looking up through the crowd, and I saw James Brown crying and stuff. And when I was young, after going to that show, they used to always say, "Daryl, do the James Brown." And I like do whatever I, you know, all the little moves that I saw.
Yeah.
But that's the first stuff that show I ever went to. I was real, real young. Like I must have been about 4 or 5 years old. They took me there to that.
That's amazing. Would you go to a lot of concerts with your parents when you were younger?
Nah, not so much. I mean, down in DC, it's like I went to like to see like BT Express and like Jimmy Cast a bunch and stuff like that, like when they would come down with like a cousin or something. But for the most part, once I turned like a teenager, I kind of like stayed in my hood. I was like that, you know, I was the only child for a long time, you know. So my sister was born when I was like 14. So for a long time I was like in my hood like that, but being able to play guitar and I was pretty good at the sports. You see what I'm saying? So, but playing the guitar and wanting to play the guitar and mainly just playing parts of popular songs enough to make people think I could play the guitar. You know what I mean? That's what I used to do. You know, I've played like "Carry On, My Wayward Son" or whatever, or like the beginning of "Stairway to Heaven."
Yeah.
Or, yeah.
So what was the first sort of rock concert that you went to, or even like the first sort of, you know, heavier kind of music concert? Like, did you ever see Parliament?
Nah, but when Parliament was big in my neighborhood and in my city, you know, Chocolate City, all that. But when they were doing that, I wasn't allowed, like my mom wouldn't let me, like it was like an exodus to the Capitol Center. You know what I mean? I could never, I would always be left in the hood. You know, that kid is just sitting there, him and the other kids. Everybody's talking about it and like Bette Davis and all those shows.
Oh wow,
But
yeah.
later on, I went on to see like Return to, for I saw Bob Marley, you know, but I didn't even go to see Bob Marley. I went to see Stanley Clark and I saw him. Like as a second thought, like why is the bass too loud? Sitting but the first punk shit, I used to be a fan of the Ramones, so I was actually in the crowd, like leather jacket, pogoing. You know, I was back.
Was there already kind of a DC punk scene at that point, or is that kind of the kickoff to it when the Ramones show up?
Well. There was like bands playing at the old 930 Club early on, you know, bands from the neighborhood, from DC, that were already there as a scene for us to show up, for them to say, "Who are these black guys that keep coming in the club?" Like black, like the Dots, but they were from New York, or like I remember we opened for these bands, or like the Slicky Boys or something like that that was in DC,
Yeah.
or like a band called Urban Verbs. Which
Yep.
was like Talking Heads. You notice how they got the same. Like there's Talking Heads and there's Urban Verbs. Then there's
Yeah.
Swimming Pool Cues, right? Which is the B-52s. So for all the bigger bands, there's another band.
It's like, what about like White Boy? You always hear stories about their shows being totally wild. Did you ever play with them early on? That was a
Oh, you
father.
talking? Yeah, Root Boy.
Well, the band that had I Can't Puke, and it was like a father and son
In DC?
in DC. Yeah, it might be,
I
I
think
don't
you're talking about somebody else. There's Root Boy Slim,
know. Okay.
right? And yeah, I don't recall any of that. No, I'm just saying you're talking like 1978 or 79 when you're talking Bad Brains. There's sometimes I sit back nowadays and I think, damn, 1977, But 1977, I wasn't thinking nothing named punk. Like, I didn't know the Sex Pistols in 1977.
Yeah.
But then I say, wait a minute. But I was in Bad Brains in 1978. It's like, and I remember thinking about, because they had this book, 1988, I believe it was titled. It was a picture book of like all the British punk and stuff.
Yeah.
I used to cut like pictures and make buttons out of it and stuff.
Oh, that's awesome. But
I remember I used to look back and think 77, it felt like 5 years, but maybe it was only two. Who knows? You know, it's like a time warp or something.
Well, that's the thing I'm like fascinated by, because you look at what you guys did in 79. It's like, that's like 1 year, and you do what most bands takes them like 6 years to do.
Yeah, it took us. Yeah, man. I mean, we were serious about it's the PMA, not so much the being in a band. And it was just more about being young and understanding what it means to have a positive progression, what it means to try to focus on positivity. You know what I mean? Not so much we're going to be a good band, but more like we got to stay positive and continue our mission of what we're doing.
Well, it's also so funny how you change that scene, you know, like just from like, you know, like bands like Billy Synth or the Chumps or the Slicky Boys and stuff. Like, it's all like it's great stuff. Like, I like it, but it just, you guys show up and then all of a sudden it's like, oh, here's where hardcore starts, you know? And then DC hardcore is, of course, this thing that's become almost like a name brand, like New York hardcore at this point. But that all starts with you guys showing up on the scene.
Yeah, but they were kind of like new wave to us sometimes, like in our interpretation of punk, they were like new, you know. So basically the Madam's Organ performance space is where all that starts, where we were allowed to say, we're going to get you guys to play a Madam's Organ. And, you know, you're talking like seven or eight people in a living room in a brownstone pogoing, you know. But for us, it was like, you know, I always tell the story. I remember when I first went to that show, and Henry was the one that helped us carry our equipment for the first time. It made me feel like, wow, man, I'm really, you know, wow. You're like, who would ever think there's someone that's going to help me carry my little amp? Then, you know what I mean?
No, it's sorry, go on.
No, I'm just saying that was Henry. I always have that vision. I remember when we pulled up, and that was the guy with the chain belt.
Well, you say about like seven or eight people in this living room, but it's like those seven or eight people changed music, you know, like so many bands. Like, it's amazing when you look at DC, how many people come out of it and just, you know, go into do other types of music, other types of, you know, Jeff Dahl's early on in that scene. Like, it just feels like it was a lot of vibrant energy.
Yeah. But we wouldn't know. See, that's the next thing when stuff like that is happening. It's like, if you're really close to it and you're doing it, and it's like, it's something that's naturally happening. That's why I've been saying this thing, the happening, you know what I mean? And I've been looking at the happening with a lot of things, music I'm doing nowadays, and just looking at what's happening or what's trying to happen, as opposed to me like trying to manipulate or guide things to what I want to see happen. So there's those things. There's what I want to see happen. And then there's the happening. You see what I'm saying? And that's what's happening. So as far as like knowing any of this, the only thing that Bad Brains knew was that we wanted to say unity, PMA, and we wanted to play fast and energetic and tight, and we wanted to be inventive with our riffs. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And that's it. We didn't want to, you know, we're not looking to be none of that really, but just that's what we're, it's a mission for us, a PMA mission. So when you hear all our first songs, that's kind of what you hear in the lyrics.
Well, you guys bring that to it, you know, like I remember reading something you said once about how early on, you know, Bad Brains was really about being in, you know, just what punk rock, what people thought punk rock was, destructive, like, you know, wreaking havoc, you know, making a scene. But then at a certain point, you guys switch and bring this positivity to it that, like, you know, it's PMA is just part of the vernacular now. And that's for me.
Yeah, that's great. You know what I mean? That's like, sometimes I would say that's my platinum plaque or whatever, you know, like that's what's great. You know what I mean? To be able to be used as a vehicle to like spread that vibe, PMA through, they say, generations, or, you know what I mean? That's what it's all about, really. The music and all that stuff, the music and the sounds and all that's second to that. if you know, like I remember HR used to be on stage and he would be saying, "We come to unite," like over and over and over and over to the top of his lungs until I'd be like, yo, chill, chill. You see what I'm saying? So we're very, very serious. Or I'd be picking my bass till my fingers bleed. You know what I mean? Yeah. We're very serious about it. So when I look back at Bad Brains, that's what I see. I see it's driven by PMA, the intensity and the wanting to achieve through positive means. You know, it's PMA, really. Yeah. To race those riffs down and hit those corners. And it's even more PMA to try to keep yourself positive when this shit, when you can't race the riffs down and you don't hit those corners. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. You're getting that. You're like, oh, what the fuck? This sucks or whatever. You know what I mean? To say something sucks is that we felt, or one of us might have felt like we didn't achieve what we said, like in terms of executing our expression.
Yeah, like I guess that's also what carries you through, like you were saying, those like early tours where, you know, like, what is this all for? You know, if you can keep your eye on the road and just keep going and keep positive, you can get through those tours. Like, that's what carries bands to this day through tours.
Yeah. The thing here is what we don't know that. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
We just I'm here sitting, I just turned 60. You know what I mean? So I didn't know that then. Yeah. I just knew I was in something. And that's what makes it so, you know, makes it beautiful for me, because I realized that we were used, and when I look back on the whole, like where we all came from and where we started and our families, you know, all of that. And then I see, this led to that. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It led to basically being who we are, creating the sound that we did, have it under a banner of peace and love and PMA, and then have it sort of start out with, I guess they would say, white kids or, you know, punks. Not back when we started, there was no black punks. You know what I mean? And that's why I never was really big on a lot of, like, I'm not, when, to us, it was a youth movement. It was nothing ever racial or anything that we could ever really see. And when I look back, we're kind of protected from all that. You know what I mean? Bad Brains was a mission, you dig what I'm saying? A divine sort of thing. So during those years, like I was there in the Berlin Wall, you know, playing in Germany, and you know, when all the negative aspects of being in punk or being in rock were real hot and on fire, and I was there talking about PMA, blazing some ill shit, and you know, basically what I'm saying is I feel we were on a mission protected. Like when people ask me about race, like being black, about being in punk, I never felt it or thought of that, not once. When I was in a club somewhere, I just was down from the Bad Brains, or I was a youth. Like, you notice in our music, we say the youth movement, the youth of today. That's what we were when we started this.
Yeah. Yeah.
The and youth.
Well, and you're, like you were saying earlier, it's the only, like one of the few places where as a young person, you're told that your ideas are smart and that you have, you know, good thoughts and that you're creative and you should put your stuff out there in the world. Like there's, as young people, you're told to, you know, wait till you grow up to do anything. Punk's like the place where it's like, no, do it now. Like it's a youth movement, like you said.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, for to see it turn into like, you know, or the slamming or the joy of like skanking like reggae after being really excited about rock. And then all of a sudden that's about this violent, like ability to like go into a concert and knock people out or whatever. You know, I saw it turn from like, there was a time when we used to churn up all that energy and then we would say, damn, we gotta, you know, unchurn this, you know what I mean? So, yeah, I mean, watching the energy go from fun loving and positive because it's physical and young turn into something like what they would say, something like frat boy slamming or whatever. And my vibes being involved in punk never had to do with race. It had to do with youth,
you know? Like you brought up with the slamming too. Like you look at the 79 video you guys playing CBGBs versus the 82 video of you guys playing CBGBs. Just the level of fan interaction, the level of just, you know, vibe in the crowd. Like it just feels like, you know, like the way you approach those sets would have to change. Like, would you ever use the reggae as a way to kind of like kind of control the crowd's energy and just kind of like bring them down after, you know?
Yeah. So I used to produce the sets, the shows, and the song lists and what. And I had it. There was a lot of things I would consider us physically, you know, like and having the energy and the material and what You know what I mean? And as far as the, I would do it like four songs of like blistering stuff, but paced out with mid-tempo stuff. Then I would throw in the reggae because not only would it calm, you know, it calms everyone down, but it still got a revolutionary feel.
Yeah.
But not like the muscle, you know, what it takes to pick like Band in DC is like a, you know, it's physical.
Yeah.
But so it was like throughout, if you peep it throughout, it would be like four joints, a reggae, and then it would be like real popular joint, most likely mid-tempo. You see, because I was considered that after we calm down the muscles and the tendons and everything and the people, it's all calmed down. Then if we come back with a real fire mid-tempo, then we don't have to kill ourselves out the bat. Establish back the tightness and the, consistency. And then pick up later because the fast songs can unravel, you know, everything. Like us and everything.
It makes the fast stuff sound even faster, you know. It just brings it's such an art to your set construction. Just, you know, obviously I didn't get to witness it back then, but like just in live recordings and things like that, like it feels like it's interesting to hear that how much thought went into it.
But a flow, a show flow, you know.
Were there any bands in that early DC scene that you felt like, obviously later on with the younger bands that were coming up, but I mean, of those older bands that you felt were kind of on the same path that you were on or the same wavelength?
Well, when I first came out for those bands, they were like big boys or something. You know what I mean? The band, like a Slicky Boys or something like that. Like, those, Kim Kane was the one that would like took us with our little demo to Yesterday and Today. You know, like they were like uncles. So and their music to me was sort of rock and roll and sort of new wave, me being young. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was into punk, which is funny. Like, I remember one time being a punk and trying to think I was Sid Vicious. I kicked like a Cars record off a turntable in someone else's apartment. Like, you see what I mean? Like, why are they playing this shit? And then it turns out Rick Ocasek. But that's like back in the days when you think like, you know, when you say disco sucks and it means something to you.
Yeah.
So for me to like think the Cars, that's new wave. So basically a lot of those groups that were in DC to me were sort of new wave and we were kind of punk. But Slicky Boys and them were like pro, you know, I subliminally pick up on their like pro style, you know, the way they look or the way they do a show, you know, all that stuff sinking into a teenage cat like me, like, getting it, going uptown to get into that scene. You see what I mean? I had to go somewhere. I'm from Southeast DC, from the hood. Mm-hmm. So to go uptown and be up in the 930 club and peeping out a band like Slicky Boys, or I keep bringing them up because they're mainly the ones that stick out in my head. And when I think why that is because I was too... They were, a lot of them back then, it's new wave. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. I'm into punk.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it seems like the DC stuff, as opposed to like the punk stuff that's going on in New York, like with the Dead Boys and, you know, obviously stuff that would come after that. But like, it just feels like you're saying, the stuff in DC prior to you guys again is just a lot more, new wave. Like, it doesn't have, it's not like aggressive.
Right. It's just not really punk yet.
Yeah.
You know, and I think by us listening to the Imports and wanting to be punk and the Damned and all that, by going to New York, where it's basically the same thing as in DC, but it's more felt more drug and more big city New York, where you got like Max's and you got like Johnny Thunders or whatever walking down the street.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? It's different.
Yeah. No, definitely. You know, one thing that gave me a lot of pride as a kid growing up in Toronto was when I found out that you covered the Viletones early on, because they're obscure here. Like, no one in Canada knows this band. And to find out that they, you know, were all in the stew that became the Bad Brains. Like, I just wondered how you first became aware of that band and where you got that single and all that kind of stuff.
So Sid, you see, he goes up to Yesterday and Today's Records, and he's probably stole the record. Right? Because, you know, he stole the 45, came back to Southeast, and it was just more because, notice how I said Sid was a bondage type punk?
Yep.
So now you think of the Viletones, Screaming Fists.
Yep.
You see how, so you got the bondage punk, black punk, in Southeast. He goes to Yesterday, the Day's Record up in Rockville, Maryland, steals Vile Tones, probably because of their name or their album or their 45 cover.
Yeah.
Right. Bring it home, put it on. It sounds like a what I describe as like biker music or something. You know what I mean? It's like it's like churning, but it's rough, right?
Yep.
And that's what probably made me churn a little bit the way that I like to feel about if I'm making some. I went on to call it like I might say I'm gonna make me some biker type shit like the Vile Tones. You see what I mean? Where it's not that, it's this driving. Like Motorhead was a little bit like that, but Motorhead was a little too fast. You gotta be churning it out. Awesome. She's making me laugh thinking about it.
Oh, that's so awesome you talk about this stuff. You don't know how long I want to talk to you about this. Oh.
Yeah. So Vile Tones, and Toronto too, you know, the Real Jerk, all that.
Oh, amazing restaurant, the Real Jerk. Absolutely. Another artist that I've always wondering if you had any interaction with, because I think he's a few years later, is Richard Sims, who played under Wicked Witch.
Oh, not. Nope, I don't know nothing about that.
I think he might have been after you moved and left to New York, which you know, but you probably
from DC.
Yeah, from DC.
Oh, I might, you know, be honest with you. That dude could have been my best friend. I felt like I forgot a lot of that. You know, unfortunately, you know, some stuff. Like the other day, I think I did an interview and I said that the Pay to Come title didn't have anything to do with the lyrics.
Yeah,
but I don't think that's true. As I thought about it more, and I realized that the Pay to Come title goes with the lyrics, but I changed the spelling being a punk kid.
Oh, okay.
Changed the spelling from C-O-M-E to C-U-M.
Yeah.
Just to change it to be like a knucklehead punk kid.
Well, that's the thing. It's like you've done so much living since these things I'm talking to you about. You know, it's just I appreciate you. Racking your brain thinking about this stuff because it's such a short period of time. Like, I know I keep saying it, but like, really, when you think about, you know, this sort of like 3 or 4 year span that changes music forever, and you arrive in New York and you talk about seeing Basquiat walking down the street, like, you've got like the birth of art, hip hop, skateboarding, punk rock, graffiti, hardcore, all of it happening in the same city at the same time.
Yeah. I remember when I used to see Basquiat, right? I couldn't understand him because that was like, I was like a Rasta, just young Rasta man. Like, imagine like Peter Tosh, like 19 or something. You know, I was like, I was straight Rasta, you know, at 20 and 21. And I used to see him and he had dreads, right? You remember, you know, Basquiat got dreads.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But to me, if you had dreads back in that time, to me, I couldn't understand this dude. It was kind of wasn't with us, like us. But I was just saying, just mainly speaking to like girl, you know, like what we're talking about, the times, you know what I mean? Like in New York, not even from DC. You notice I know more about what happened in New York than as far as that sort of stuff than the band, the people you mentioned that were in DC. I don't really, in DC, I know Urban Verbs, Slicky Boys, Judy's Fixation. Mm-hmm. They had one called a metal band called like Rock Candy or something like that. That's all, you know what I mean? But I was like 18 or 19 years old, just starting to like be Daryl, and I didn't really know a lot of that stuff.
Well, it's funny because like from people I've talked to and people who've been on the show from DC, it's almost like you guys plant the seed and then move to New York, and then the seed kind of blooms while you're in New York.
Yeah, you see, the key with that is people sort of maybe need to understand that us being under the influence of Think and Grow Rich and PMA and Napoleon Hill during that time, it taught us that when you start to like conquer something, you got to move on. So we left DC to move on because we were doing our thing in DC. Like you probably heard me say, like the band in DC is not, no one banned us in DC. That's like a song we put to. Once we started playing and people started coming a lot and the club owners are upset, you know, the chandeliers are shaking or what have you. Yeah. And then we start to think in our PMA minds, it's time for us to go, you know, and that's how you can get like a hometown hero, you know, like love to Kim Kane and Slicky Boys and all that. But I think they may have fell prey to that. Mm-hmm. You know, they needed to leave. But you know, DC culture, it's like Washingtonian. You see, you notice with Ian and all them dudes, you know, it's a lot of Washingtonian in that.
Yeah.
Bad Brains is universal from Washington, from Washington.
Yeah. No, and it's like you were saying, it's almost like you had to go to New York to kind of to plant the seed there, because that's what kind of happened.
Well, we went to New York because we learned through PMA that once you conquer something, move on. You don't stay right there in your victory. You see what I'm saying? And that's what that's all about, going to New York. That's what it's all about. Nothing about no gigs or no shows or nothing like that. It's about knowing in positive progression that once you conquer something, move on and conquer the next. You know what I'm saying?
So you guys kind of go to New York. Is it the first time you go to New York in 79 and play CBGBs?
Yeah, or maybe Tier 3.
Okay, like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so what were your impressions of kind of coming to the city? Because it's an interesting period for New York. Like, it's kind of post-punk being this huge thing and pre, you know, New York hardcore really starting to go in, or that next wave of New York hardcore. So what were your impressions of the city and the scene when you kind of got there?
Man, it was like... like, I was on the Bowery, you know, when it was the real Bowery, you know what I'm saying? It was like what people, you know, the Bowery, like bars, like Valentine and drunks laying around. And I used to think, like, Uptown was like St. Mark's, just to give you an idea of, like, coming from another city and coming out the Holland Tunnel and going up to get near CBGB's, mm-hmm, and sort of staying in that area. So it was like a big city, like, struggle. If anybody knows New York back then they know what I'm talking about as far as, you know, downtown and all the stereotypes that go, you know, like the dope and Avenue C and Def is D and all that shit's real.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And like, you know, the clubs and CBGB's and it, and, you know, Hell's Angels and Gildersleeves and the Mad and over at Max's with all the drug sort of groups. You know, I can only just paint a picture of what, if anyone was in New York back in like the late 70s and early 80s, and I'm sure before that, I'm from DC, I'm not from New York. So dude would tell me, dude, you should have been there in 77 or 6, you see what I mean? Mm-hmm. So New York was dark, dirty. But really, for me, being a teenager, coming up there, New York was about CBGBs, point blank. I didn't care. I'd sleep on the floor. I'd sell loose joints out in front. You know what I mean? Yeah. It was all about Bad Brains and CBGBs. It's the only reason why I was there. You know?
Was the first time you went there when you played there?
Yeah. I never went there. And when we played CBGBs, the dude Merv, that used to be there, that they show him in the movie with the hard hat on. Mm-hmm. They were all really nice to us. And Hilly would tell the Hell's Angel to leave us alone, and they would let us in for free. And one other thing I remember about playing for the first time at CBGB's, when we first played there, it was like, I think it was a Tuesday or a Monday. And then after we played that Monday, then Hilly moved us to a Thursday. Then after we played that Thursday, he moved us to like Thursday and Friday. It was like we were wilding it out. And this is when CB's had like theater chairs in it, like, you know. And that's what I was saying. Like, me and Doc and all of us would, like, you know, we're a band in New York. We're broke. We're strictly a band. And we would like sell joints, and like I would go downtown, buy a nickel bag, knock that down to 15 joints, sit in front of CBGB's and go loose joints for people going in. And then once I got my money, I'd have a nickel for my own weed. I'd buy a 40-ounce brew, me and Doc. We'd buy like a mac cheese and find some place to cook it.
Yeah.
Eat it. Go back to CBGB's because we could go in for free, you see.
Yeah.
And then go in and sit up on the front row of those theater seats that they had and put our feet on the stage and watch all the bands that we play. And some of those bands, like there was a band called the Bloodless Pharaohs, and that's the dude... that's Seltzer or whatever from the Stray Cats.
Oh, yeah, okay, yeah.
So people would never know that dude is like a sick guitar player, like Al Dimeola or something, like Mahavishnu. That dude in the Stray Cats, I seen him in a band called Bloodless Pharaohs before. When I saw them playing rockabilly, I was like, what the hell happened to him? But sitting in there in those theater seats with my feet on the stage, right? And there's a lot of bands that I saw, like I mentioned that one, the Swimming Pool Cues.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And they were from Georgia, and they were the other B-52s. Like, exactly the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah, they get going right away. Like, Fred from B-52s was just on the other week, and he was talking all about them being, like, they were, like, the next wave after them, and, like, the little brother band, I guess.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, that's what I'm saying. I saw a band from Georgia called the Swimming Pool Cues that were kind of doper than B-52s. But, you know, I don't know what happened to them. You know, it just showed me, you know, one, how, like, the type of blinders that I must have had, you know, had on, or we had on being Bad Brains. Because as I got older, I would think back and look back. Like, I remember when the Chili Peppers came and opened up for us at in L.A. at the Lingerie. I thought they were, like, the couldn't understand how they got on the bill, because they were kind of like making fun, you know, they felt like a frat boy sort of thing, like,
yeah,
like funk group.
Yeah, there's a amazing story I heard from about Pat Smear getting a call when he was working at SST Records from them, and they're like, hey Pat, we want to know if you want to play guitar for the Chili Peppers, and this is before Blood Sugar Sex Magik, but they're still popular. And mm-hmm. he's like, you guys still playing that funk stuff?
Yeah.
You
know? Exactly.
And they're like, yeah. He's like, oh, I'm good. Just, he's like, hangs up. He's like, I could do without that. Thanks.
Ain't that something? Yeah. You know, and even my homies, my little homies, the Beastie Boys. Like I saw when, like, rap start, you know, I saw that. And I'm like, man, you guys making fun of the rap stuff or whatever. Like,
yeah. Yeah. No, it's amazing how that stuff gets taken up differently.
Yeah.
Years later.
Yeah. Yeah.
Going back to, you know, coming into New York, you mentioned the Mad, and that seems like a band that you really kind of, you know, like, obviously the drummer becomes your manager for a time, and you mentioned Screaming Mad George. Like, was that the band that you kind of fell in with closest, would you say?
Yeah, we lived with them. Like, they let us stay there. You know, we were seriously four dudes that took off to New York with nowhere to go and nowhere to live. So yeah. We would live day to day, like, not, you know. And I never wound up not sleeping on the bench, like, in Tompkins Square Park. But we seemed to have, you notice how I said we would find a place to cook the mac cheese and stuff, you know. Yeah. There was a constant, like, looking for a place to, you know, cook or maybe shower. And so Screaming Mad George let us stay up in this place, and yeah, that's where I remember writing Stay Close to Me. And yeah, man, Georgie and him and his, like, special effects and all that stuff.
Well, yeah, that's the thing. He goes on to become, you know, one of the most respected special effects guy. Does, like, the Reanimator movies.
I know. I'm not even tuned in all the way on that yet.
It's so good. I mean, yeah, no, I don't blame you, because you obviously, you know, you were doing your own thing, but it's just amazing once again, out of this scene, you know. And I've seen all these great videos of them. He used to do, like, special effects on stage, right?
Yeah, man. Some of the freaky. I used to watch him make that shit, like, putting it. Like, one time I saw him, he was making shit, right? He had, like, peanut butter and all this stuff. He was putting in a plastic bag, and a Ziploc was going to put it in his back of his pants. And then he had, like, he was making it so he had, like, four arms, right? He had two other arms that were like a puppet. And he went to do the show at Max's, and then he was bugging out doing his Screaming Mad George shit, and he reached into his pants and pulled out that shit. I was like, you're nuts, dude. But I remember that shit, though. But that's my man, man. God bless him, and I love him. If it wasn't for the Mad and Screaming Mad George and Dave Hahn and those dudes, God knows, because, like, you know, that was where we could go. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Being from D.C. and not have to go home.
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. You know, you talked about him earlier. You mentioned the Dots, and Jimmy from the Dots, once again, rest in peace. He produced the first single, right?
Yeah. Yep. Now, when they were the Dots, they played at the old 930 club, and it's like, I don't know, they felt like Dead Boys or something a little bit. Mm-hmm. But I don't, you know, I was really young during that time, and my bigger brothers was kind of handling getting to know them and recording with him. But from what I can remember, just like Rick Ocasek, they heard of us or heard or saw or did something, and they saw us, and they said, yo, let me record you guys. And for us, it's just like, you know, we've got to remember, we're just like the lowest, you know, we're just some dudes from out in D.C., out in Maryland. And, you know, it was great to like people were picking up on our energy or our drive and wanting to step in and help us. So yeah, we recorded Pay to Come, Stay Close to Me up in New York, and some shit that was looked like was called the Money Building. And we had a single. It was like, oh shit. And we sat around a table and blew the sleeves together and got our high school buddy, claims he was a printer, and you know, there you go.
But it's like a thousand, you know, it's one of the most important records of all time, you know, like as far as 7 inches go, like that was, you know, it's perfect. It's like a perfect record.
Yeah, I didn't know. I don't know why I knew Pay to Come, but the other B-side, which I wrote that song, and it's another story on how I came up to even want to write something like that. It's kind of like Clash influenced in a way now, if you go back and listen to it. So the Clash was having a big influence on us with the Rock Against Racism and you know, being like the Clash. So Stay Close to Me is kind of a Clash influenced song. Pay to Come is a Ramones influenced song.
And they're perfect too. Like you were saying about the live set, like you want to have that balance. Like I think it's such a,
yeah,
it's like a perfect dichotomy. Right,
I don't know. Now, if it was me, I would have probably, if I had to go back in time, I wouldn't have put Pay to Come on the other side. I probably would have put like How Low Can a Punk Get or something.
Okay, yeah.
You see, so it's like a happening. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. That happened.
Yeah.
It's reasons why that went down like that. But if I had to do it again, I would have never thought like put this song on there.
Yeah. Well, like you're saying, it's like that causal relationship where things just seem to like everything leads to something else. And if this thing didn't happen, then all these events that come after wouldn't have been able to happen.
Yeah.
What about Jerry Williams? Like, when was the first time you saw the Cigarettes? And was that when you met him, seeing that band first?
Nah, that's a good question, man. Wow, that's a good question. How the hell we wound up down there at 171A? I think we might have been walking up and down the street and heard music, guitars coming from out of there. And, you know, and the rest is history. Yeah. Like, I think that's what happened. I don't think we saw the Cigarettes or anything. I think just being down on the Lower East Side, and then Jerry had that space. And so we wound up probably going in there maybe with Dave Hahn or somebody. And then we just, like, I remember the Cigarettes, but Jerry, he used to be weird. Like, he'd be wearing that scuba outfit and what have you. He used to be sweating and shit. I'm like, what the hell? I missed that dude. That was my dude. But he would like, you know, he would like, you know, we would smoke weed. And it was just like a little club, a little family of rockers, you know, that was building down there with us. And, you know, like the Stimulators and Harley and everybody. It was a great time.
Yeah, and it's really like the foundation of like that next scene that's going to start, like the quote unquote capital H New York hardcore thing that starts next.
I don't really know nothing about that, and I feel bad because I can't really speak on it. Like a lot of kids come to me, Darryl, I'm from so and so, and the only thing I could say is, dude, I don't even barely even know like one Fugazi or nothing, you know. Yeah. You see what I'm saying? I don't know all that. I'm from the damn. You got to holler at me about 999 or fucking Buzzcocks or something, man. I don't know none of the other stuff.
Well, and also I think it's because you're too busy influencing all the other stuff that's happening, right? Like it's, you guys are already kind of going as a band. I find once it becomes your vocation in your life, you can't stay attached to the scene in the same way that you were able to before that, I find.
Yeah, but I never was paying attention really, you know, to other bands. To me, it's just all about busting the set. You see what I'm saying? To me, it's all about busting the set. And to me, it's like a football team or something that practices on in a week. They're going to go this way, that way. You're going to hit the hole, all that. That's what I'm thinking in terms of Bad Brains busting that set. Like when we come out with this, kick into that, kick into this, kick that. Like I need, it meant a lot to me, like to execute. And I would get real, you know, I'd get bummed out if I couldn't do it, because mainly just based on someone wanting, like you see like a fighter or a boxer saying I didn't stick to the game plan, or I got too happy, or I got too this or too that. Mm-hmm. So it was in terms of executing anything, you know what I mean? Not much less punk rock. But to me, it was about execution. So we rehearse, or we come up with something, and we put it together. They say we're gonna bust it out here at this place. We go to that place. I wait for everybody to stop doing what they're doing. And then I get up there and I like, all right, let's go. Like a football team when they go up there and before they say hut, hut. You know what I'm saying? When they come up on the line and shit. You dig what I'm saying? You look at, imagine this fine tune, like hut, hut, bang, and everybody hit the hole. This guy does that. This guy does that.
Yeah.
That's what I was doing to make, I guess, when people say, as I look back and my brothers and us together were doing to execute our bust, our set, or our songs and present our idea. Like, we didn't get lost in rock and roll. We never jam. You see what I'm saying? That's pretty wild what I just said. We didn't get lost in rock and roll.
I love it. I love that.
How about that? How about that, huh?
Very true.
Like, we never got lost in rock and roll.
Yeah.
And we never jammed.
So you guys
only time we jam is on the reggae. We never jammed hardcore or rock.
Wow. So you never practiced those songs. It was just from playing live that they were that tight.
It's from rehearsing them, coming up with them, understanding the corners and execution of them, and then being brothers and getting up there with one mission and busting it.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? And then if we couldn't bust it for whatever reason, there's a lot of reasons that come in why it's hard to bust. There's a lot of reasons, a lot of things. You see what I'm saying? Factors that over the years we learn how to deal with, like a stage dimensions or monitors or, you know, a lot of little things that can... When you're doing something as fast-paced and as energized and as demanding as busting Bad Brains, you know, to do it. But that's when I learned about chemistry, you know. Not, sometimes things that seem like they're imperfect or not so perfect in that is actually making a stronger, a more muscular expression. You see what I'm saying? Like shit too tight might be too sheer. You see what I'm saying? And shit that's not as tight as you envision or what you think, or maybe with a little... bump here and there, actually, and even more so out in the crowd coming through a PA, it's like another whole thing. It's like a stew or something, you know?
Yeah, well, it's like you're saying, it's like that, it's, you have to ride that line. Like, you want it to be tight, but you don't want it to be too virtuosic that it sounds like some guy on YouTube just jamming in his room.
But it can't be tight. So people, what I'm saying, I could want it to be, like I always said later on, if it was left up to me, the Bad Brains probably would have sounded like Metallica. You see what I'm saying? If it was left up to me because of the way that the riffs that I wrote them and what I was envisioning.
Yeah.
Right? What I envisioned for the riffs. But then when I got with my brothers, maybe, you know, everybody's different and everybody, and that's what could have caused frustration. But then as you grow more mature and your ear develops, you start to understand what chemistry is. And then you start to appreciate the chemistry and you start feeling less connected to your interpretation of art. You see what I'm saying? So it took me being a tight ass about wanting everything to be tight, my brothers wanting shit to be tight too, but maybe their tight's different than mine.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? Which I hear now later when I listen back. But then what that does is cause a little friction. And then now if you've got something as fast paced and as energized and as mission oriented as Bad Brains, and now you gotta add a little friction. I laugh at my own shit, kid.
Oh, I love this. And Daryl, I've kept you forever. Would you come back at some point and do a part two?
I could, man. I never really did this. This is a podcast, right?
Yeah, it's a podcast. And I'm not hurrying you off the phone. If you still want to talk, I'd love to talk.
Oh, no, I could talk to you forever. But the thing is that, you know what I mean? I don't want to come off. You know what I mean? I just want people talking to you. I don't know. I've been quarantined. You know what I'm saying? I'm just saying, I don't know what the hell. I'm telling you what I feel and what
Dude,
I know.
No, this is amazing. It's honestly, I'm not, you know, like, I'm not blowing smoke with this at all. Like, this is a dream come true. And just hearing you talk about the stuff, the way you're talking about, like, hearing you talk about how much you like The Damned, like, that to me is so badass. And
that's one of my favorite groups, man.
Oh, me too. I love that band. And they seem like they were a band that, like, had a role in your journey, too. Like not a role, but you guys intersected with them.
More The Damned, like that brings to mind this. There's a few people out there that I know that are prominent or whatever. And some every now and then they want to try to tell me Bad Brains is dope, but they're Black Flag. See what I'm saying? Like some people. I'd be like, man. So I say that in my era. The Ramones is dope, but I'm The Damned.
Yeah. Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? The Ramones is dope. I'm not going, the Ramones is the dope. Dopeness. But I am The Damned. You see what I'm saying? The way I like the way The Damned was kicking their shit. And we went on to like have some experience. Like they was going to take us on tour. You see what I'm saying? That's how we wound up, went to England and got deported and all of that, because we opened for them at in DC at this club called The Bayou. And they were really impressed with us and they offered to take us on tour. Mm-hmm. And we sold all our equipment. We didn't have equipment and we had no money and we bought tickets. Back then, I think it's like Freddie Laker Airline or some shit back then. And we arrived in London and went through customs. And as we went through customs, they denied us entry and then took us and put us in this shit called like the Beehive or something. It's like out in the middle of the airstrip. And they kept us there all day. And then when the flight going back to New York, they gave our passports to the pilot. I told them, don't give us our passports till we land back in New York. So I'm just telling a short, quick story about how the Bad Brains opened up for the Damn. They said, damn, Rat Scabies, we want to take you all on a tour. We sold all our gear. See, this is what people got to peep when they think about certain shit. Like, how are you going to go doing a tour with no gear?
Yeah, yeah.
All right, but we said, we're going. We'll figure the gear when we get there. This is how we figure this. We sell the drums. Earl just bought those drums himself working. And we sold those drums, and our guitars got stolen in front of our faces. So we landed in there, and I was the only one that got through, actually. You know, I was the only one. I was the youngest one. The lady asked me if I had money. I had two dimes and two pennies.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have any money. I remember I reached in my pocket, but by the time I went to show her or try to say I didn't have any money, she stamped my passport. So, but here's a funny story about that. Rat Scabies' father had a wooden hand, and he came down to try to get us out, and he couldn't. And so we got, but his father, I always remember that he had like this wooden hand.
Oh, how long was that tour supposed to be? Was it just a couple shows? Or was it like a full tour?
I have no idea. That's again, like HR or Doc, like a bigger brothers back in that time would know more about that. Yeah.
Like you said, they're amazing. And they just seem like a band that kind of gets like, almost like you're saying, like it's like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, but they're like the Who, like they're the band that's like, the band that never really gets brought up, but the band that just seems like well, they're just so good. They're just so good.
Yep. So big up to them, you know?
Yeah. And Rat Scabies seems like someone who got it. Like the fact that he would see you guys and know, shit, we got to do something with these guys.
I don't think I ever saw him again. Maybe once. It was weird. It's like we never really, I don't think I saw them again. You know?
Yeah. Well, before I let you go, one thing I would love to ask you about, and as I say, this has been incredible, would be that the Bond shows that you did with The Clash, because those shows are so legendary, and I just wanted to find out from your memories what they are, what the reality was like versus the legend.
All right. But I owe the Ramones and them this. When we opened up for the Clash, and I never would say this about the Bad Brains, and I don't boast Bad Brains. Trust me, it's not in my nature. But Bad Brains, in the height of our doing whatever we do with our music and our styles, we kind of blew them off stage that night.
Oh, I don't doubt that for a second.
Yeah. All right. And what happened was, and then Dave Hahn was backstage in the production office and said that Don Letts was on the phone to London and said these urban black punks just destroyed the stage. Right. And Dave Hahn heard him say that. So these are my heroes, right? The Clash, or one of them. So when I went out after that set, they kicked me out from backstage. And they made me stand on the other side of the velvet rope or whatever.
What?
For the rest of the... Yeah, and then I was standing there. My heart was broken.
Yeah.
And I watched them walk by to go on stage, and they all looked like Barbie dolls or something. You know, they had their collars were starched up. You know, they were the Clash. They were starched. And ever since then, I kind of always felt like, you know, but I always felt like, yeah, y'all got smoked. But I never would say that about the Bad Brains. But they definitely got smoked. I mean, they're the Clash. So after a while, nobody even knew we were there. But to come out and start turning that up, they knew that it was a problem.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And also, the Ramones did the same thing, but even worse. So we're opening up for them in your country at some shit called the Infest or something like that. I don't know if you heard it or remember back in the day. So we're in Canada and we're opening up for the Ramones.
I've never seen a flyer for the show. Where was, do you remember where it was in Canada?
It was called the N-Fest. It was in Western. I seem to remember. Okay. I can't remember vaguely, and it might not even have been. It could have been like Seattle or something, but I feel it's Canada. It's called N-Fest.
Okay, I'm going to look it up. Definitely.
Yeah, yeah. So we're playing. We're and it's outdoors, mm-hmm. and we're kicking it. And then we get to the last song, is Reignition. So we crunching Reignition. The people are going nuts. All of a sudden, the whole stage goes like bloom black. The shit is like ding 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 ding. All the amps, everything. Right. So I'm wondering, what the hell? Get this. I run off stage. What the fuck happened? The promoter said, the Ramones said, if we didn't get you off stage right now, that they're going to go back to the airport and go back to New York.
What? What a bunch of assholes.
Can you believe that? They cut us off during the song.
I will definitely say I'm not defending them at all with this, but also at the same time, there is no band that I would fear playing after more than you guys. I could not imagine sitting backstage and being like, Sheena is a punk rocker, is not going to cut it tonight.
Yeah, but if you keep kicking it, no one's going to know we're there. This is one thing I learned about bands that actually did good opening up for us.
Yeah.
And popular bands that I'm thinking, damn, this place is going bananas, right? It's like, how do we stand up to this? And what I learned about that was, it doesn't matter if you're headlining, you're going to get juiced, because eventually the whole energy of the show turns towards you, no matter how dope you are. Mm-hmm. You could be killed. Oh, you know, there's an exception if you get killed. Yes. But if you're just getting killed, by the time that headliner hits you with those lights and all that shit.
Yeah. You know, it's different. Yeah, right. Like the PA's louder, everything PA's about it.
Louder, the attention. But they might take a while. Like this happened a lot with like James Brown and Prince and stuff like that. And like Rick James and, you know, the Rolling Stones, you know, with somebody like really strong. And they go, oh, these dudes, we can't deal with this every night because, you know. Mm. But it shouldn't be that way. And Bad Brains was never that way. And that's why, like Big Brother HR, we used to always involve everybody in everything we did. You know what I mean? And you can ask anyone that knows us, when we come to your town, if you want to come on stage or you want to meet us or you want to play for us or open up or whatever, we're down. We were a real community type band, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, and it goes back to what you're saying. Like, that's, you know, what we've been talking about. Like, that's what you guys brought to hardcore, is this idea that this is community and this is like PMA, you know, and that's what gets you through when you have the band that's opening for you, that's really good, or you're opening and you're trying to be good. If you're just positive and in your own shit, you can do it.
And see, people should understand that came from like Maurice White from Earth, Wind & Fire. That came from Big Brother HR being a little brother to Maurice White and this whole way, you know. So with Bad Brains and our generation and our situation, is Big Brother HR carrying the torch of PMA and getting us to, like, you know what I mean, stay on the PMA track.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Well, anytime you want to come back here and dig through these memories, please know, Daryl, you're always welcome.
Appreciate it, Damien.
Thank you, Daryl, for coming on the show. And you heard right there, hopefully, Daryl will be back at some point in the future for a part two, because that's one of the best episodes ever. I had to stop this thing several times while listening back to it. You know, just because I was like, oh, this is too good. I don't want to rush the edit of this thing. That's it, though, for that. I guess, yeah, check out the Bad Brains. Check out anything Daryl Jennifer's involved in. He's been involved in a lot of really cool projects and continues to be involved in a lot of really cool projects. All right. That's it, I guess. Okay, on to next week on the show. We got to keep it going. We got to keep this energy going, right? So how about a part two week? Next week will be two part twos, kicking it off with Joey Keithley, Joey Shithead, part two. And this is a fun one, you know, and like if Bad Brains are the best live band of the era, DOA is number two, because they are the band that gets talked about constantly as being, you know, the other band that would come to town and just destroy stages. So we get into all of that stuff next week with Joey. It's a really fun conversation and a great kind of follow-up to this one. It really does go really well with this one. So that's it. Oh,
Oh, I'm excited. How am I going to go to sleep now? I gotta get a couple hours of sleep somehow. Oh, well, that's it for me. Remember, as always, Black Lives Matter. The lives of Indigenous people matter. We need to protect trans kids, and we need to help trans people protect themselves. Research, read, get involved, look into organizations and groups that are doing good work right now. See if you can donate time or money or you know, whatever. Basically, the long and the short of it is smash fascism, you know, like fuck Nazis, like legitimately, we don't need them at all in this world. Sign your organ donor cards, please. Go and do that, because by the time they come looking for those organs, you don't need them anymore, and it gives gifts to other people. And I can speak from you know, a family experience of someone getting an organ transplant, and you know, it gave them a new, not even a new lease on life, just like life. You know, it really, really was an incredible gift for someone to do. So please sign your organ donor cards. Go out in there and make your own culture. You know, start a fanzine, do whatever you need to do. Start something. And just, you know, you don't even have to put something out in the world. Just draw a picture. Draw a picture for yourself. Just do something creative. And it helps. It helps with your mental health. It helps with a lot of stuff. So try it. Try meditating too. I'm a recent convert to this thing. Those hippies, they have magic. And meditation is the latest that I've discovered for myself that seemingly the world has known for years. But yeah, try it. You know, it helps. And that's it. I think that's all I got, right? Yep, that's it. Oh, listen to Oil and Flowers with myself and Buddha Blaze. We talk about cannabis. It's a fun podcast. And that's it. All right. See ya next. Oh, check out Punk as Fuck over at Flood Magazine. Definitely floodmagazine.com. Check out Punk as Fuck. Some hilarious videos of me going around LA talking to people about punk rock. And yeah, definitely check those out. Okay, that's it. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll see you next episode.